Good afternoon, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. And as this is a Monday and it is just after 1 o'clock, that means it's time for all things political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're going to spend the hour talking about politics, always one of our favorite topics here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And joining me is one of my favorite people to be with on the radio, Lily Gorin, professor of in the Department of Politics and Global Studies at Carroll University. She's an expert on the American presidency within a historical context, branches of government, and the impact of popular culture on citizenship. We'll get into some of that this afternoon as well. Lily Gorin, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being with me today.
It's my pleasure, John. I always enjoy chatting with you as well.
So lots of grist for the mill, as it were, even though this is technically the holiday season and we kind of expect things to simmer down politically in the era of the 24/7, 365 perpetual campaign machine. I guess we really can't expect that anymore.
No, I don't think so, although it is definitely one of the slower news weeks, generally speaking, in part because most people who are elected officials are, in fact, usually at home. and while they do periodically pop up on the Sunday morning talk shows and on some of the 24-hour stations, they are often spending more time with their family this week.
Well, I'm glad that people are spending some time with us on the radio today. And if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon and make your contribution to what we're talking about here, you can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a different number than we usually use for the Kathleen Dunn program, 800-642-1234. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And one of the things Lily, you and I have been talking about in email, what we'd like to do today, one of the things we want to do is, and I really want the audience to weigh in on this, is take a look back at some of the top political stories of 2013. So I'll just prime the pump for the listeners. I'd like to hear what you thought was the top political story of the past 12 months, and we'll talk about that. We'll probably hit a few of those before we get any phone calls, but let's talk about some more recent things. There are some things happening, some on the international stage. President Putin of Russia is having some problems with terrorists just in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics. There are some other issues surrounding those Olympics as well, including a little jab. I think President Obama took at his anti-gay stance in naming certain individuals to represent the United States over there. But let's talk about the most recent. There have been a number of suicide bombings in Russia. This is seen as something of a political hit that the Putin administration is taking over there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the bombings in the last 2 days, basically, or, you know, sort of 40 hours, are to expose, at least by the people who are perpetrating them, that there may be some security issues with regard to the Sochi Olympics. And one of the things that, you know, Putin has said all along is that they're going to provide a safe environment, as all the, you know, countries that host Olympics say that they're going to do. And of course, this always recollects what happened to the Israeli athletes in Munich in the 1970s. And so, as well as, you know, the bombing that transpired in Atlanta in the 1990s, I think it was. And so that there's, you know, there's concern with regard to the safety of the athletes and, of course, the safety of the fans. People plan to go to the Olympics, and they want to know that they're going to be safe.
That certainly is probably not issue number one, the safety of people at those Olympics. And President Putin has reassured people that they will do whatever they have to in terms of security to make sure that people are safe, but there's no such thing as a perfect plan, and
yeah.
So you know, anything, I guess, in this world, almost anything is possible, even the unimaginable.
Exactly, and I mean, and Olympics are big targets. You know, they're high profile. They're broadcast internationally. Millions and millions and millions of people are watching them. both for the opening and closing ceremonies, as well as the sporting events themselves. They're usually high-profile politicians, although, as you mentioned, a number of the usual politicians are not attending, the ones in Sochi. But it is this, you know, sort of very high-profile event, and it's an opportunity for the host country to demonstrate, you know, they're welcoming, and it's a great place to come visit. You know, there's a lot of tourist dollars involved with hosting the Olympics. And that's one of the reasons why you know, Russia wanted them, and as well as most countries want them. And so Putin sort of needs to get in front of this as opposed to behind it.
Well, he has a lot at stake here.
He does. He does.
I mean, they've invested an enormous amount of capital in this. There's been a lot of criticism about the location and the lack of snow, and among other things. But, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism, and both from within and without Russia, and the way the whole thing has been managed. And, of course, there are always accusations of corruption and this and that and
right.
the other thing. But he has he's staked a lot on the successful hosting of these Olympics. It's one thing to get the bid, but now you actually have to put on a show. And as you pointed out, literally the whole world will be watching.
Exactly. And it is, you know, it's also the sort of after effects of the event that people see someplace that they'd never thought about visiting. And the whole Olympic Village is then, you know, is still there. So people often go afterwards to visit the Olympic Village and to, you know, ski on the slopes that the Olympians skied on and so forth for the Winter Olympics or what have you. And so it's not just the actual Olympics, but it's also the highlight of them for the future, that people will say, oh, I know where Sochi is, and they had a great time watching the Olympics, and then they want to go visit it.
Other news from Russia, and we don't want to stay on this too long, but a couple of other quick things we want to mention. A Putin rival was and harsh critic was released from jail recently, and at least two of the members of Pussy Riot were also released. Is this a signal of a kinder, gentler Vladimir Putin?
I'm not necessarily convinced it's a kinder, gentler Vladimir Putin.
I forgot to turn on the irony font. I'm sorry.
Because I'm not necessarily sure how possible that is. But I do think that, again, it's an attempt to sort of soften some of the images both around Putin himself and around Russia with its, you know, sort of Soviet history and authoritarian history. And to sort of say, look, we're open, and we have democratic policies, and we have freedom of speech, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you're seeing a lot of that. I mean, you often see this with some of the more authoritarian countries when they are hosting the Olympics, in terms of, you know, how they try to change the image around a little bit. In anticipation of how people are going to then view the country as they're watching the Olympics.
Another international story, which is, all of these things are political at some level, what's going on over in the South Sudan. And the interesting thing to me about this, and I almost hate to use the word interesting because this is a horrifying circumstance over there, but one of the curious things about this is I'm reading that some experts are saying that this isn't about ethnicity, that it's not about religion, it's just about power.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I've been reading about. Basically, the sort of jockeying that's going on and some of the bloodletting around that, it is about holding on to power and preventing other people from getting power.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is the world's youngest country. And it was part of another country that has had a pretty rocky recent history, not just politically but also economically, and suffered from any number of real and created famines and so forth. And it's, you know, it's to some degree heartbreaking to see what people were looking at as, you know, sort of this advent of democracy or sort of a peaceful resolution to what had been a very difficult and often quite bloody situation, and now it's kind of disintegrating.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, people are wondering what the United States' response to all of this is going to be, and it sounds to me like that's, as everything else, evolving.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's kind of an internal power struggle, and how the United States gets involved in an internal power struggle, as we've been dealing with such cases in Syria and so forth, is often hard to determine, or mm-hmm. it is evolving, as they say.
Yeah, and there was just another news report. You mentioned Syria. There was just another news report that the Obama administration has kind of opened up some communication with an Islamist group, and people, of course, as soon as you say that, Obama administration and Islamist group, that raises a bunch of red flags for people of a certain point of view. But it's kind of like when you look at Syria, who is there to talk to? I mean, it's a very crazy situation.
And the situation in Syria has always been sort of there's no good option from what, you know, I sort of understand of the situation, and I am no expert on Syria or, you know, sort of the power and political dynamics there, but basically there seem to be generally no good options.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to give the phone number and email and all that again, and I'd like to invite people to join our discussion in all things political. What's on your mind? What political story has piqued your interest over the holidays specifically? And maybe thinking back to the entire year of 2013, what was your top political story? What do you think was the biggie? Was it the government shutdown? Was it the whole debate over the budget? The fact that Congress actually passed one for the first time in a number of years. What was it? The ACA rollout and the problems with that. The changing fortunes of the various political parties and so forth. Lots of grist for the mill, as we say, and plenty of opportunity for you to join us. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number you can use to call us to join the Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And the Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook. Look us up there. And you can post your comment or question, and we'll share it on the air. And so whatever way you choose to get in touch, please do so and join our discussion. Lily Gorin is my guest, and we'll be here until 2 o'clock talking about all things political. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to turn our attention to national political news. Just to give you kind of a preview, there is a Washington Post story on the red state, blue state divide, and we'll talk about that. Benghazi is in the news again with a New York Times story and reaction to it from members of Congress, both parties weighing in on that. We will talk about the top political news of 2013, all that coming up. And we also have a bunch of state political stories to talk about as well. We'd like to hear from you on all of that. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and it's all things political this hour. My guest is Lily Gorin, a professor in the Department of Politics and Global Studies at Carroll University. Lily, Benghazi is in the news again, or maybe still. We have a New York Times story talking about an extensive investigative report that they've done, and according to them, Al-Qaeda was not involved in Benghazi. Members of Congress beg to differ.
Yeah, I mean, and this seems to be the situation in Benghazi was one that, from what I've read, I certainly wasn't there, was very fluid, and there were people who were perhaps associated with Al-Qaeda who were around the attack, but it wasn't a coordinated Al-Qaeda attack. I don't know if that's, you know, splitting hairs or not, but that seems to be what the New York Times reporting sort of concluded.
And there was reaction from various members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat, who took some issue, Republicans more than Democrats, some issue with the conclusions of the report. And I don't know, it as you say, it was a mess no matter how you look at it. And it just, you know, kind of depends on whose stories you you place more credence in.
And it shouldn't be overlooked that the post where Ambassador Stevens was basically a CIA post. I mean, it was technically State Department, but it was a CIA post. And that, I think, is a complicating issue that has been part of the story, but not front and center for a lot of the story.
Mm-hmm. Congress, of course, is probably all by itself the top political story of the year, both for what it failed to accomplish and the circus that is Washington, D.C. Let's take a call because that'll help launch our discussion. And then there are a lot of topics related to this that we can get into. We've got an email and some other things. So let's hear from Dan in Prairie du Chien. Dan, good afternoon.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering, why is it that when Congress shut the government down, why do they get paid? If I don't go to work, I don't get paid.
Dan, that's a great question, and I'm sure it's one that a lot of people were asking when the government was shut down and things weren't working. Lily Gorin, that's neither rain nor snow nor dark of night will stop the congressional paymaster in their rounds, apparently.
Part of it is requirements that Congress is actually paid. Members of Congress are actually paid. As part of the requirement is by the Constitution. Same thing with the president gets paid when there's a government shutdown. And when there was a government shutdown in the 90s, Clinton tried not to get paid, but he's required by Article 2 of the Constitution to get paid. The issue with regard to Congress is actually a lot of them had their staffs working during the government shutdown, and the staffs weren't getting paid.
That's against the law.
There was like this what was deemed essential and non-essential personnel, and the offices, you know, House members, Senate members had different interpretations of who was essential and non-essential.
Hmm.
And at the end of the shutdown, though, they did retroactively, I believe, vote to pay their staff.
Well, and regardless of which side of the aisle you were on for this one, I don't think anybody was covered in glory at the end.
No, the odd thing was, yes, the government shut down, but members of Congress actually continued to work to try to get to a deal.
Hmm.
One can take issue with perhaps how hard they worked, and perhaps they should have worked harder before they shut the government down, but many of them were actually still there trying to hammer out some sort of deal.
Well, I'm using the government shutdown to kind of open the whole discussion of Congress as its own political story. You had the events leading up to the shutdown, starting with Senator Cruz getting, the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives was giving John Boehner fits. And Deb in Plymouth sent us an email. She says the story of the year has got to be John Boehner finally chastising the Tea Party, but that didn't come until later on. For a lot of observers, it really looked like in the House of Representatives the tail was wagging the dog.
And I mean, I think it was part of it that there were these negotiations or conferencing between Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and perhaps and Mike Lee, I believe, also, who's from Utah, I believe, but I could be wrong on that one, and a number of the folks who are in the Tea Party caucus in the House, because the Senate had passed the budget, but the House didn't pass, or the continuing resolution. It wasn't the budget. It was a continuing resolution. And that was, sort of where the attempt was. And of course, Cruz was out in front, basically saying that they were doing this at that point to stop the implementation of the ACA, of Obamacare, which was going to go forward to some degree regardless because they didn't have the votes to repeal it at that point.
And of course, some were saying, listen, let it roll out and hope that it fails. And, you know, and then that's an actual bigger story, one you can really use instead of kind of pursuing the course they did. But for a lot of people in the far right wing of the Republican Party, opposition, continued opposition to the Affordable Care Act is sort of a litmus test.
Yeah, and it seems to have become a kind of litmus test, the way that, you know, pro-choice, pro-life is for a lot of politicians, either Republicans or Democrats. It's now, you know, you can't really say that you support it or you're willing to work on it, although there seem to be cracks in that because our very own Senator Ron Johnson has basically said he's now moving forward with trying to reform it as opposed to necessarily repealing it.
Well, he makes the point that it's too late to repeal it because
right.
It's already here and you've already got people on the exchanges and buying insurance and so forth. And so it's really too late for all of that. That train left the station a while back. But, you know, let's try and fix what's wrong with it, assuming we can all agree on whatever that might be.
Right.
There was quite a – I wanted – we mentioned the Affordable Care Act. That's an issue where the we had the government shutdown. Republicans looked awful. Their approval ratings fell to the lowest probably in history. And then they rebounded people weren't happy with the way the Affordable Care Act rollout was going, all the computer problems. And now Democrats are kind of on the defensive, which just goes to show how quickly things can shift.
it's always changing in politics, and that's part of what you're seeing, I think, in terms of the actual rollout of the ACA. The website was a disaster, and that was sort of what was interesting also about the shutdown, because the shutdown happened exactly as the rollout started. So there was about 2 weeks of cover that the Obama administration had, where people weren't actually paying all that much attention to what a mess the website was, because the story was all about the shutdown and potentially busting through the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm. And then you had the whole, if you like your insurance, you can keep it,
right?
Which is now a key portion of the Americans for Prosperity, I think I got that name right, television campaign against pretty much anybody who supported the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Take us forward in time in terms of how important do you think all that's going to be by next November?
Which part?
Well, you know, this whole it's become sort of a meme, if I can use that term, of the quote unquote broken promise about being able to keep your health insurance even if it's horrible.
Well, I think, you know, that one's around the neck of the president, and that's a tough one for him to shake, but he's not running in 2014, although his party is, and he's leading the party. And so various elected officials who are running for re-election can try to distance themselves a little bit if they didn't ever say that.
Mm-hmm.
But it still is, you know, it still is part of the rocky rollout of the ACA. If it's just that line in particular, it actually affects a small number of people, not a minuscule number of people, but it doesn't affect, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. But it is, you know, one of these sort of lines that people are sort of pointing to and saying, see, government can't do anything right. And I think that's the bigger story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that gets lost in this is, and I don't want to put words in the president's mouth, but, I mean, from his point of view, he had to be thinking, well, listen, if you've got some really crappy insurance policy, why would you want to keep it?
And I think that's, you know, I think that's where that line came from. I think. I don't know. Again,
yeah.
Work for the president. So.
Probably better not go down that road. 800-642-1234. We've got callers on the line. Let's go to San Francisco, and David is on the phone. David, good afternoon.
Hey, morning, or afternoon for you. I was interested in the economy, and I'll just tag it on to what you were talking about with the shutdown of government. One of the big ways that America got suckered was by this Texas Senator Cruz, who claims to be a Tea Party man of the people kind of guy, but in fact his wife is a vice president of Goldman Sachs, and her territory is so big that it covers from Mississippi to Colorado, including Colorado. So the idea that ruining America's credit rating, ruining America's faith and credit, forces us to pay higher bond rates, and who's there to cash in on it but Goldman Sachs? So the idea that America still hasn't latched on to this, basically I would call that treason, to ruin America's credit rating so a guy's wife can cash in, seems a little dubious, but they, the GOP, in their Ike and Mike kind of standard, are still thinking of running old Senator Cruz for president next year. And as a matter of fact, I've been calling Texas radio shows just to inform them of this, and it seems like now the Texas legislature is trying to remove the Texans' electorate ability to vote for the U.S. senator. That it would be the Texas legislature that would elect the U.S. senators. So it's just similar to what's going on in Michigan with the corruption over there with their governors, you know, robbing the state blind and claiming to be man of the people, but they're really just part of the old money boys that like to cash in on the downfall of the country.
David, thanks for the call. Lily Gorin?
Well, there was a lot in David's commentary. Texas has been making noise about essentially trying to do something different than what the 17th Amendment to the Constitution says with regard to the direct election of senators by the people. And they've been making noise about this for 2 or 3 years now. I talk about it sometimes with my students because the 17th Amendment was passed, I believe, in 1913 or so. And it was part of the movement to essentially, you know, instill more direct democracy into the United States, is not, you know, around the time of women's suffrage movement as well. And this is kind of an interesting little piece by populist Texas, which has always been about, you know, sort of government close to the people and smaller government and populism and so forth. And so it's a little bit of a twist that they're making noises about somehow reinterpreting the 17th Amendment.
Mm-hmm. It was May of 1913, by the way, that the 17th Amendment became was finally ratified.
Okay.
Just in case anyone was wondering. Thank you, Google. I wouldn't want anyone to think that I carry that information around in my head. Speaking of Texas and elections, though, there are probably some other stories coming out of there that are perhaps more important than any effort to circumvent the 17th Amendment. There's been a lot of noise over the past year about changes in how people vote. There was the Supreme Court case.
Yep.
On the Voting Rights Act, all of that. That's been a huge political story this year.
Yeah, and again, the sort of the Voting Rights Act was, parts of it were nullified by the Supreme Court in terms of saying that there are still some issues, but the issues that it was created to address have to some degree subsided. And if Congress wants to do this better, they can go back and reformulate those sections of the Voting Rights Act. And so any number of states immediately then moved to basically take what the court had said is fine and to run with it. And Texas, of course, was one of them.
And in Texas, the one of the big issues was all of the hoops that women specifically had to jump through.
Yeah, it seems to have adversely affected the female sector of the population more than most other sectors of the population in Texas, whereas other states it generally adversely affects mostly low-income individuals and African Americans. Mm-hmm. But the women seem to be taking the brunt of it in Texas. because of they have to produce a number of pieces of ID, including their birth certificate, and their last name has to match it. And most women, when they get married, do change their name, and so that becomes a complicating issue.
Mm-hmm. And even Jim Wright, the former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, had trouble coming up with the right documentation to be able to vote in Texas.
Yes.
And so these stories continue to come out. One wonders what final impact they will have. But certainly women are riled up in the Lone Star State.
And one shouldn't mess with Texas women, I don't think, but on either side of the political aisle.
I try not to mess with anybody. I mean, that's my policy. I don't want to mess with anybody. I don't need any more drama in my life. Let's take a quick call here from Greg in Madison. Greg, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. And I think the number one story for the year is the improvement in the economy. We've had economic growth, and actually the sequester, as much as people yelled about it, kind of went through without a hitch. And both factors together resulted in a dramatic reduction in our deficit. So it kind of makes the Republicans complaining about the deficit's argument a lot weaker. And the capstone on that is they agreed that the sequester cuts were stupid, passed legislation to rearrange cuts in spending, and the Fed decided to end quantitative easing.
Hey, Greg, thanks for that. Lily, I want you to respond to that. The economy does seem to be improving somewhat, and we are seeing a shrinking deficit. But part of that budget deal that was made ended up cutting off unemployment benefits for several million people across the country. And there are people who are saying, well, that's just going to drag the economy down further. So put that in the context of the whole economic discussion, will you please?
Well, I think that Greg is right to point out the improving economic picture. The difficulty and the lack of the extension of the unemployment benefits that transpired, I believe, that took place on Saturday, is for the long-term unemployed, people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months. And that's where this recession is still being felt by a lot of people who were initially targets of the recession. They lost their job that they had maybe for, quite a number of years, and they were trying to figure out and find new employment, but they still were unemployed. And by cutting off the extension of long-term unemployment benefits for a sector of the population, that's pretty spread out across the country. It's not concentrating in any particular state. It may, in fact, drag on the economy because there are also people who had been, contributing to the sort of chugging along of the economy with, with some spending, not great spending, but some spending. And once you sort of cut that out, you're going to sort of pull on the economy again that's still in a fairly fragile state. Although the Fed does think that, they can pull back on the quantitative easing, so they're going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see who wants to join us in the rest of this hour. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we still got some state issues to talk about. Lily Gorin is my guest. She is a professor in the Department of Politics and Global Studies at Carroll University. We have some interesting news about tax policy discussions in the state. Apparently, there have been some closed-door meetings between the lieutenant governor and business leaders about tax policy in the state, even some discussion about abolishing the state income tax. J.B. Van Hollen says he won't run for re-election as attorney general. So what is he going to do? Run for governor? Run for the Senate? Run for Congress? What is it? A big story, at least in my part of the state, Lily Gorin, the Army Corps of Engineers has said it will not work with the Department of Natural Resources on the GTAC mining project in the Pinoki Hills. And Governor Thompson wants Governor Walker to run for president. We'll talk about all of that, and we'll take some more phone calls as well at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. It's a toll-free number. Please use it. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. 1234. Email is talk@wpr.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Leave your comment or question there. My guest, Lily Gorin, professor in the Department of Politics and Global Studies at Carroll University. The a lot of news on the state level in politics, including some apparently, I hate to use the word secret, let's call them behind closed doors meetings about tax policy between the lieutenant governor and others in the Walker administration and business leaders. Some people saying, "Hey, that doesn't sound right."
Yeah, and I mean, I've read the stories, and in part because they seem to involve discussion of eliminating the state income tax. It seems like something that should be widely discussed by the people of Wisconsin as well as the elected representatives, as opposed to a fairly quiet discussion behind closed doors.
Well, we'll have to see what comes of it, but certainly there were people who were upset by that. J.B. Van Hollen has said he won't run for re-election as Attorney General. So two questions. One, what Republican will run for that office? And then what's J.B. Van Hollen going to do next, do you think?
Well, if Scott Walker runs for president, somebody needs to take his place, potentially. I mean, obviously, Walker is running for re-election next year as governor. I don't know who will run in J.B. Van Hollen's place as a Republican or a Democrat. So I'm not an expert on the actual inside machinations of those sort of political situations at this point.
Well, it isn't something that's been widely discussed yet.
No, no. So I got no information on it.
And there is some discussion, though. We mentioned the fact that Governor Walker said he's running for re-election. Who's going to challenge him coming up, do you think?
Well, again, it's, you know, sort of one of the difficulties that the Democratic Party has had in Wisconsin is beating Walker either the last time he ran or in the recall. And in both times you had Tom Barrett, who ran, a Tom Barrett campaign, and neither time did he beat Scott Walker. And so my suggestion to the Democrats, if they're listening to me, and they may or may not, is that Tom Barrett's probably not your candidate. Who is the candidate is, you know, again, remains to be seen. Walker is more popular than he was, although that doesn't mean he is unbeatable.
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly the 250,000 new job thing isn't going to fly.
Well, I mean, I don't think the statistics are going to indicate that we have acquired that many new jobs in the 4 years that he's been governor.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're not, you know, Bureau of Labor statistics, if there are different statistics, I still don't think that many jobs have been created in the last 4 years in Wisconsin.
What do you make of Tommy Thompson urging Scott Walker to run for president?
Well, I mean, it seems to me, as somebody who observes people potentially running for president, that Scott Walker is doing his own setting up of the presidential campaign. He's got his book out, which is what you do when you're going to run for president. He's been taking trips to places like Iowa, which, again, is nearby. He's been doing some fundraising in places like Florida and California. Maybe he's not going to run for president, but I think he's probably going to run for president. And Tommy Thompson basically said it helps the state if you get elected president. So it helps the state if somebody from Wisconsin gets elected president.
Of course, that raises a whole host of issues. The first of those being how would Governor Walker fare with the National Press Corps?
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't run a campaign at a national level. Paul Ryan ran at the national level as Romney's VP choice, and he's had that experience now. And Ryan has also been, to some degree, more involved in national politics. But Walker has, you know, equipped himself well over the last 4 years by spending a lot of time on Sunday morning talk shows. People, you know, national press reporters know who he is, and many of them have actually talked with him in one capacity or another, particularly during the, you know, the sort of demonstrations in the Capitol and so forth. But running a national campaign for president is actually a major difference than running in a state like Wisconsin, which has not that many people compared to other states and certainly compared to the entire country. Not to say that there aren't a lot of people in Wisconsin. There are. They're great Wisconsinites. But it's a whole different ballgame running at the national level.
Let's take a couple of calls here. Al in Land O'Lakes. You'll be next. Al, good afternoon.
Hi, how you doing? You keeping warm, I hope.
Oh, yeah, it's toasty here in the studio. I'm just not going outside.
Yeah, 24 below here this morning.
Oh,
yikes.
Anyway, I wanted to make some comments. First one was on Ted Cruz, who not only looks like Joe McCarthy, but he uses his tactics. Like when they were trying to confirm Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense, suggesting that he took $200,000 from North Korea, which was a total lie, but that's very McCarthy-like. Anyway, and then about Scott Walker, suggesting that Ted Cruz or Scott Walker run for president is very disconcerting because they both work for the Koch brothers, and everybody knows that. And then the comment that I wanted to make about President Obama is when people talk about him, I wish they would give him the respect of the office and address him as President Obama. And then I also wish that they wouldn't call it Obamacare. It's the Affordable Care Act. And I don't think he was wise in letting them use that term, Obamacare. It's the Affordable Care Act. I and everyone I know who went bankrupt did it behind medical bills. And sure, it's not perfect, but I'm really happy that someone's trying to address this. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Al, thanks for the call. Lily?
He brings up a number of topics in terms of, Senator Cruz, who's a junior senator, hasn't been in the Senate very long. And I also think is positioning himself to run for president, as well as Scott Walker. And I think that, a lot of times people do refer to Obama as Obama or President Obama, the same way, I've referred to Bush as Bush or Clinton as Clinton. And the difficulty with the ACA, as I generally call it, is that most people sort of know it as Obamacare because that's what it's sort of been dubbed by the press. And when you start talking about the ACA, people don't necessarily think about it as the ACA, the American Cares Act. But I think the caller has a point with regard to it being the ACA, the American Cares Act.
And this had an email from Bob in Stanbury who reminded me there was a story I kind of left off the list when I was preparing today, but it's a huge political story. Bob writes, so what do you make of the Republican reaction to what the Pope has had to say about capitalism?
Well, I think the Pope is making a splash. I think it's across the board. He's the Time Magazine Person of the Year. I just finished reading a piece in the New Yorker that was generally very positive. He's definitely, almost diametrically different in terms of his presentation of himself from Pope Benedict. And there isn't necessarily a bunch of change in terms of church doctrine because he's not making changes in the doctrine from everything I've read. But that his presentation and how he is embodying the office of Pope, because it is an office, he's appointed by the cardinals, is much different than the way that Pope Benedict did, and to some degree different than even Pope John Paul II, right? He was the second.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think so. And he's the first Jesuit in the office as well to become Pope, and I think that has also been part of some of the difference that, that you've seen. He's from Latin America. He's not European. In terms of his actual birth, his parents were Italian. But I think he's emphasizing different areas of the doctrine, and that seems to be making some people a little bit upset and making other people sort of happy or feeling welcome. But he's not necessarily changing the doctrine from what I've read.
Yeah, that's a key point. We've got a couple of calls I'd like to get to before the top of the hour, and then I've got one more big question for you, Lily. Jerry in Menasha, we'll go to you next. Jerry, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I am weary of branding the ACA as the Obamacare by both the media and the GOP. The ACA is actually traced back to the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank in Virginia, who prepared the legislation. It was taken up by Mr. Romney in Massachusetts and should be called RomneyCare. And when it was called RomneyCare, the GOP had nothing to say about it. It took 10 months to roll that program out in Massachusetts. It had lumps, bumps, and humps. And when it was in place, way over 90% of the people liked it. Once it became Obamacare, suddenly the GOP turned on it and tried to repeal it and tried dragging their feet on it and hoping that it collapses. Enough already. Enough of this hypocrisy.
Okay, Jerry, thanks so much. Lily, quickly.
And she traces the history of the policy exactly correctly, that this was a policy proposal from the Heritage Foundation or the Heritage think tank that was adopted by the Romney administration when it was in Massachusetts and implemented with a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor in Massachusetts and became known as RomneyCare there. And this was what was proposed by the Obama administration and a lot of the Democrats in Congress as a means of essentially helping many people who don't have access to health care get access to health care.
Mm-hmm.
And so the evolution of the policy is exactly as Jerry has noted it.
Ray and Rhinelander, you're next, and I can give you about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yes, briefly, do you think the climate is right for a woman presidential candidate? And who do you think might be really good to run for that, or many to run? How many women?
All right. Ray, thanks. Is it time for a woman in the White House who would be the president?
Sure, absolutely.
And who would that be, do you think?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is thinking about it. Susana Martinez is probably also thinking about it. Nikki Haley is probably also thinking about it. I don't know about Sarah Palin, but there are Christy Gillibrand is probably thinking about it. Elizabeth, Warren in Massachusetts is thinking about it. Perhaps even Tammy Baldwin here in Wisconsin. Any number of women on both sides of the aisle
You mentioned Tammy Baldwin, and that was another big story, political story we didn't get to this hour, really, and that was huge advances in gay rights in 2013.
Yep. Yeah, I think that was one of the actually bigger stories this past year was just the states voting for it, courts in states voting for it. You saw that in Utah in the last 2 weeks, the Supreme Court of the United States striking down the DOMA at the federal level, lots of evolution on same-sex marriage in the United States.
Mm-hmm. We got about 30 seconds. Very quickly, what did you think was, what was your favorite, maybe not the top, but what was your favorite political story of the last year?
I have to say there's probably a tie between my following of Anthony Weiner's run and demise in New York and the Toronto mayor, Rob Ford. If you're following sort of popular culture and politics the two of them were very interesting.
Couple of train wrecks. Holy, how would you like to be their handler?
I would quit. I think most of their handlers, in fact, have quit.
That would be hazardous duty. Lily Gorin, thank you so much for spending this hour with me.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, John.
Lily Gorin is a professor in the Department of Politics and Global Studies at Carroll University. She joined me today on All Things Political. I'm John Munson. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley, on-air production by Robin Cherry. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.